With Hurricane Irma making landfall in mere hours in Florida after devastating the Caribbean, and with wildfires raging through significant patches of land west of the Mississippi River, it's easy to feel very overwhelmed right now by all the environmental-related events happening in our world. And indeed, until we fully recognize that the role of social media and individuals play and that role in the cycle of news, emotion and rumor, well, they're always going to get involved. And so let's face it, in the chaos of large disasters and big news stories, much less when there are several happening at once, facts are more important than ever. So tonight, we're going to take a look at the hurricanes currently in the Gulf, the devastation that Hurricane Irma has already caused in the Caribbean, and take a look at it as it is due to make landfall in very heavily populated areas of Florida this evening and in the morning. We'll also take a look at the facts surrounding wildfires that are spread out around much of the western United States, and what we do and do not know about the role of our changing climate and about how vulnerable we are to hazards in our world. Indeed, it is hard to watch disaster or impending potential disaster from afar. But as our climate shifts, and let me add here, let us agree that climate is changing. And the vast majority of scientists are in agreement on that and warning us that climate change is real. So I say that because tonight will not be a discussion or debate about whether or not climate change is real, but rather it will be a discussion about increasingly severe weather and environmental behavior and how climate is and is not factoring into those things. Because tonight we will be talking with experts and dealing with science, facts, and data. But throughout the program, we will also be very mindful about the potentially life-threatening conditions that are unfolding in South Florida and of the casualties we just saw in the Caribbean, including several islands that now, even days later, we have not heard from or have heard very little from due to constraints of infrastructure and communications. We're not focusing on just United States lives or land or property damage tonight, but human ones, and looking at climate and weather around the globe because it's not concentrated or held to any border or any people or any citizenship, but in fact, something the entire world must address or continue to face consequences in weather and temperature, in resources and in lives, like conditions we are just now beginning to see. Tonight, we'll be taking a look. We'll be talking with a Gulf-based meteorologist about hurricane data we're seeing this evening and the latest as Irma takes aim at Florida. We will be talking with a former spokesperson from the National Park Service about those wildfires that we're seeing throughout the West, with a Northwestern University professor who led a study about climate and its impact on our lives and environment. And we'll talk with a professor who will discuss the natural hazard vulnerabilities of our most populated areas. As ever, we have a lot to do tonight, so we'll be right back to get this conversation underway on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we pick one big topic and talk about it all evening, many different aspects of it. And with all the activity happening right now in the Gulf and with fires happening in the western United States, we figured we had to talk about that and address those things. So tonight, the focus is really on weather, environment, climate, and our hazard vulnerability. Those are not small things to tackle in the span of 2 hours, but as ever, we're going to do our best. So we're joined now by phone by Dr. Stephen Strader, who is from the Department of Geography and Environment at Villanova University. Dr. Strader, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday to talk with us about this. And so a lot of your work really centers around our hazard vulnerabilities. And so as we are looking at the evacuations that have been happening in South Florida, the last group of them that were just happening in Houston as Hurricane Harvey came in to the picture, how are you following these evacuation orders and what insight can you give us into them?
Well, it's something that most of us in the hazards research community follow very closely, mainly through social media and government-sponsored websites. National Hurricane Center has been excellent, and so have emergency officials in Florida, in terms of getting the word out there and telling people early enough so they can leave. One issue with Houston that they were trying to avoid, and they're still trying to avoid it with Irma, is, you know, people leaving too late and getting stuck in traffic. So, you know, it's been a successful evacuation, hopefully, of about 7 million people. People in Florida is continuing to go. There's still some time to get out. But it's a difficult process, especially when we just dealt with the Houston floods and Harvey itself as well.
Right. And so in your work, you talk a lot about this idea that of the expanding bullseye effect. Can you walk us through a little bit of what that is and how that applies to situations like we're seeing right now?
Yeah, myself and Dr. Walker Ashley at Northern Illinois University have been working on this for roughly 4 to 5 years, maybe even the precursor to this work further back. But the idea here is that the hazard, the climate set aside, things like tornadoes, things like hurricanes, wildfires, isn't solely responsible for what we've seen with increasing disaster frequency. The main idea behind the expanding bullseye effect is that targets, so when I say targets, I mean people, their things, especially homes, their possessions that they have, are enlarging as populations grow. The way I like to think about this is, imagine what your hometown looked like or your city looked like 30, 40 years ago. But as they grow, that is also influencing disaster impacts. And by that, I mean they are literally becoming more people to be struck by a tornado or more people to be struck by a hurricane. In general, that is also increasing as climate is affecting the hazards. So while climate change may actually amplify hazard frequency or magnitude, the root cause of escalating disasters is driven by the underlying human exposure. There's just more people than ever before. There's more things than ever before that also influences disaster. And disasters don't occur where people are not located. So we can't look at, you know, hurricanes are getting stronger or whatnot. We have to also focus on societal changes as well.
Like those population centers, like as we're talking about looking at where Hurricane Irma will be making landfall over the next several hours, we're looking at, is that going to be a major population center or is that going to be a less populated area? And so then that, I think, immediately begs the question of how vulnerable are we in the average city to these kinds of hazards? I mean, obviously, if you're coastal, there is hurricane, but the average city in the U.S., what are we looking at in terms of a natural hazard?
Well, this is where it gets difficult because location is key. Florida is a very hazard-prone state because there's a lot of thunderstorms and their hurricane risk is high. If you take Irma as an example, people want to live near the coast. It's beautiful. People like the coast. They like the beaches. Unfortunately, it's not the best place to live. The saying is those that live near the water will eventually have to live in the water. And that's mainly related to storm surge and flooding. Florida is a good example of how we've actually began to build ourselves in a more vulnerable positions as people with kind of forgetting about our true risk. Houston's a good example of letting our cities kind of continue to grow and create concrete jungles that are prone to flooding. And, you know, places like Oklahoma City has a high tornado risk, and we need better building codes. Unfortunately, no city is safe from the effects of hazards. If you take Chicago as an example, the Fairdale tornado a few years ago, if you displace that from where it occurred in central northern Illinois over downtown Chicago or in the suburbs, you're talking about maybe the worst tornado disaster on record. So these are all chances of things that can happen. So there's other ways that we can combat those effects other than just sort of letting them occur and just reacting to them.
And so what are those ways? I mean, immediately I'm thinking, okay, how do we mitigate that short of just stemming population growth, which I don't think is going to be a good option for anybody.
No, exactly. And that's what we're not trying to tell people to do that. That's a very unrealistic and a very dangerous thing to say. And it's not a about limiting population and limiting, you know, the number of people. That's a given. That's going to something. That's something we have to deal with, is growing populations. However, things like better land use planning. A good example is Houston started replacing coastal prairies that are like sponges for water with concrete and parking lots and impervious surfaces. And that led to greater flooding issues. We're doing the same thing in Florida, where we're replacing marshes and swamps. We're filling them in and creating islands and building resorts on top of them. That's poor land use planning in terms of trying to mitigate disaster impacts. Zoning is another issue with flooding. We tried to do this with the National Flood Insurance Program, where people who live near the water should pay their true risk in terms of insurance because they live in a riskier area. And then lastly, I think the most critical thing that we've seen that's going to be important with Florida and places like Oklahoma is better infrastructures, better infrastructure in general, retrofitting of older structures, better building codes to withstand wind and water and other hazards, just better quality building and construction. Those are some of the things we can do in conjunction to better education to society, which is we get better every single time something like Irma or Harvey occurs.
And so I think immediately to some local political leaders who have sometimes been thrust into the spotlight when disasters have occurred in their cities. And so what can we learn from them? I'm thinking of New Orleans officials during Katrina. I'm thinking maybe it's too soon to really comment on Harvey. But yeah, as we've seen big disasters and our public officials respond, or, you know, even being willing to perhaps mitigate future disaster with funding or access, things like that. What can we learn? Or, I mean, are there themes we see again and again? I'm kind of getting at, are we seeing the same mistakes made over and over again? Is there kind of a shift we need to make here?
In some ways, we see the same mistakes with building codes, with letting people build right back to where they were before. But in general, what we can learn, or what we know, is communication across all levels is key, all the way from senior officials making decisions down to the public. One thing that sort of revolutionized how we communicate hazards and disasters to the general public has been the advent of social media. What we've learned recently in the last, you know, five years, 10 years, is that Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all these social media networks are avenues for communicating to people. And that's actually made our lives, you know, easier at times, but more difficult at times when we're trying to tell people, you know, you need to get out, you need to take shelter. We're constantly working as hazard scientists and us in the research field, trying to partner with local officials, emergency management officials, National Weather Service employees, to work on bridging those gaps of communication between the public and the actual people issuing warnings and evacuation notices. We know that that is key. What we fail to do sometimes is really understand issues if we've never seen them before. And each individual disaster is unique in its own way. And it's just a very difficult thing to do, but we're certainly better off now than we were, you know, even a few years ago. We're better at communicating it. I think that the issue is that we could do better on the land use planning. We could do better on the zoning issues to sort of keep us from building back into regions that we shouldn't be in the first place, which is, you know, in floodplains and things like that. We don't need to be there as people. It's humans are full of hubris in that case.
That is a really interesting point. Immediately, I think of how here in Chicago, the Chicago River, engineered to reverse the flow there so many years ago. But, you know, earlier today on the Weather Channel, there was a little bit of a discussion with one of their reporters who was down there near the Florida coast, talking about how there tends to be, if there's a major warning issued for a hurricane and it ends up being a relatively minor event, then the following year, it tends to be much more difficult to get people to evacuate because in their minds, oh, this is kind of a false alarm. They, you know, this is the boy who cried wolf. Is that a part of it too, of just kind of humans, we want things to be okay. We want to convince ourselves it's not going to be as bad as sometimes it is.
Yes, that's a very good issue. And this is sort of a point I was thinking of today was damage will be done with Irma one way or the other. And by that, I mean, of course, there's going to be homes destroyed if it makes landfall, which we're pretty sure it will. We know there's going to be damage. We know people will be affected, and that's devastating. Unfortunately, those areas that thought they were going to be worse off a week ago or a few days ago, what that does is that creates that it reinforces their existing biases that or biases that basically say it won't happen here. It can't happen here. And those are the things that we have to fight as researchers when we communicate to people, because it's very difficult to take away people's mentality that, oh, we'll be fine, or oh, it can't happen here. It happened before. It won't happen again. Or last time I was okay, because we never know what this time will be. It's trying to convince people to spend a dollar now to save a dollar later, or $2 later. They don't like to do that. And there's multi parts to that. It's very easy for me to say that, but some people that are in the path of Irma, they're maybe choosing not to evacuate or can't is the key word. They really just don't have the means to. They don't have anywhere to go. They have pets, they have animals that they don't want to leave behind. There's a lot of other issues there on the individual level that is difficult to sort of fight, and we don't understand it fully. And if we do understand it, we don't know how to make that individual choose to leave. And unfortunately, I don't think we ever will. And by that, I mean, I can tell people to take shelter. I can tell people to do all kinds of things, but ultimately, it comes down to their choice, and that's a tough thing to get people to do because it is opinion-based, and they do have to have somewhat a lot of faith in science, forecasters, and understand the process, but not, you know, very, very small portion of the community is actually trained scientists or meteorologists or even emergency officials.
Right. Indeed. There is sometimes we are our own worst enemy, and our stubbornness is part of that. Indeed. Well, Dr. Stephen Strader, thank you so much for being with us. We will continue to look at your work in Department of Geography and Environment at Villanova University. I really appreciate you being with us tonight. You've given us a lot to think about.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Okay, we're going to take a break, get you to news here in just a bit, and check in on the latest as Hurricane Irma moves into the area in Florida. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we take one big topic and we spend the entire program looking at different facets of that topic. And tonight we're talking all about weather, climate, and hazard vulnerability, particularly as we are watching and keeping you updated on the events around Hurricane Irma as it is scheduled to make landfall. And we're beginning to see some of that impact in South Florida after we've seen it come through the Caribbean. We're joined now in studio by Dr. Daniel Horton from Northwestern University, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences. Welcome to the program. I appreciate you being here tonight with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you did a study that really outlines the framework for measuring the impact of climate change. If you would tell us a bit about that.
Sure. So this was a team study, and it was actually led by a professor at Stanford University. And what we were attempting to do with this study is it was based on a question that we get as climate scientists all the time. And that's when an event occurs, an extreme weather event, whether it's a heat wave or a drought or a wildfire or a tropical cyclone, we often get a phone call. And that phone call typically comes from somebody in the media or many people in the media, and they want to know the answer to the question, was did climate change cause this event? Did climate change make this event worse? And that's essentially what this study attempts to do in a very rigorous scientific manner.
And so how did you even go about answering that question? That just seems like such a almost impossible to answer even question, really, because it's so big and so vast. And it seems like, of course, you're the expert, not me, but it certainly seems like there are so many factors that go into that, that it would be very hard to determine. So where did you even start looking at that question?
Yeah, so I should mention this particular type of science is called attribution. In the climate sciences, it's attribution science. Now, there's different sorts of attribution science, and our particular study was focused on something called single event attribution. So we're talking about individual storms or events. But there's another type sort of attribution that I want to make clear, and that's when you look at how things change over very long time periods. So not talking about individual events, but let's say talking about changes in global average temperature. We have already vigorously and robustly attributed changes in global average temperature to human causes. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change comes out with a report every 5 or so years, and the last one that came out in 2013 said that it's virtually certain that humans have caused warming of the Earth. Due to increases in greenhouse gases. So that's one form of attribution. Now, the form of attribution we are working on was single event attribution, so single storm attribution. And we are not the first people to do this. So it is a really complicated question, but we didn't necessarily come up with the first ideas on how to do this. What we've done is kind of, there's different methods that people use to do this attribution. And we've incorporated several of those different methods. And instead of looking at, say, one particular event, like the Chicago heat wave of 1998, we look at the most unprecedented event, the most unprecedented event in the observational record. And then we attempt to figure out whether there was a human contribution to the occurrence of that one particular event all over the world. And so one of the main complications to this is that the world is not super well observed. We have very good observations of temperature. We have less good observations of precipitation. And things like tropical cyclones, like hurricanes, we have even less good observations. So we only have observations from satellite-based measurements back to the 1970s for things like hurricanes.
Right. So it gets complicated quickly when you don't have all of this symmetrical data. And then I think it's probably tracked in different places in the world in very different ways, which is, I'm sure, making it even more difficult. And so as you set down this path and started on this study, what were the first things that you found that really seemed very profound and surprising to you?
Yeah, so the key thing that we decided we needed to analyze was we wanted to be able to understand the physical causes of the actual events. And so there's lots of statistics involved in this study, but we really wanted to make sure that we understood the physical reasons why things might be happening. And we wanted to make sure that the changes that we saw occurring could be attributed to something that we understand to be a physical consequence of increases in greenhouse gases. And so we really tried to dig into these physical causes. And the way that we talk about this is looking at things from what we call an ingredients-based approach. And so many of the extreme events that we talk about are incredibly complicated. If you want to talk about a drought or a heat wave or a tropical cyclone, there's lots of meteorological ingredients that go into that. And so if we're talking about a hurricane, for instance, there's things that are very important to the occurrence of that hurricane and the intensity of that hurricane. And these can be things like the temperature of the air, the moisture that's in the air, the temperature of the sea surface, and the temperature of the ocean water down to a depth of about 100 meters. We need to look at the amount of shear in the atmosphere. So this is winds blowing in different directions as you proceed upward in the atmosphere. And lastly, you can also look at the steering flow. And so that's kind of the, which way is the event going to move. And so all of these things come together to form an extreme event. And what we like to do is pick them apart and analyze the individual ingredients independently. And that allows us to say something about the changes and the underlying probabilities of these events or these ingredients that lead to the events.
Right. So when someone calls and says, was this caused by climate change? It's no quick answer.
It's not a quick answer. And typically we don't try to answer the question, was it caused by climate change? Mm-hmm. We try to answer the question, are events like this more frequent because of climate change? Potentially, right. Or we try to answer the question, was the event made more severe or more intense because of climate change?
Yeah. And I know in particular in the case of Irma, a lot of conversation is happening right now about that water temperature, because a lot of people are focusing on the fact that it's got to be in the, I think, upper 80s to keep a hurricane that robust. And here we're looking at about 90, 91 degree water. And so I think that's an area of a lot of concern. And I think that's so that becomes a quick leap, I think, in the public narrative on social media. People are going, oh, the Weather Channel just said that climate change caused the, you know, and it as you're laying these ingredients out, that it's really not so straightforward. And it's very difficult to talk about these kind of things, you know, outside of this field. And you probably know that better than anyone, right? That speaking with colleagues is one thing, but then when you have to convey that message out to the public, when you have to put it on social media, all that, it gets distilled and sometimes it becomes inaccurately, displayed.
That's true. And there's also the element of, you know, science operates rather slowly. I can spend upwards of a year to 2 years writing a single 4-page paper. And that's not the speed at which media and particularly social media operates.
Right. It's not Twitter speed.
No, not
at all. For sure. Many, many things to consider. We're talking with Dr. Daniel Horton from Northwestern University. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences. We will continue this conversation here in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate you sharing part of your Saturday with me. Well, as ever, we take one big topic and we start looking at it from a lot of different angles. And tonight we are talking all about weather and climate and hazard vulnerability. And of course, we're talking about that as we are watching everything that's happening in the Gulf with Hurricane Irma. And we have wildfires happening in the West. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in the next hour. But there's a lot going on. And so it's sometimes easy, especially on social media, it's really easy for rumor to spread and speculation to happen. There's a lot of conjecture in the world right now. And so we thought we would just bring in an expert to help us think through that. So we have Dr. Daniel Horton from Northwestern University in the studio with us. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences. And he did a study that really outlines the framework for how we measure and think about climate change. And so he's here talking with us about that. And so far, I have learned from him that there really is no straight and quick, fast answer to when we can say, hey, was this made worse by climate change? No, we can look at many different factors and look at them individually, but even then, perhaps not such a straightforward answer. So I want to get back to your study a little bit. And as you started down this path and as you've studied more and more in this area of around climate science, what are the things that people tend to get wrong? Other than that, maybe that tendency to want a quick answer or the tendency to speculate about what is and is not connected to climate.
So, yeah, the desire to have instantaneous answers can lead people to say things that, to that point, they haven't, I would say, robustly attributed. I will say, though, that despite the complications that we've talked about, the science has evolved to the state now where we can confidently attribute some of these single events. And we don't do it from a causal standpoint. We do it from a probabilistic standpoint. And so we can say that, in our particular study, we looked at unprecedented hot extremes. So this is the hottest extreme that has ever occurred at a grid point on the Earth. And we were able to say that out of all the places we have quality observations on the surface of the Earth, over 80% of those unprecedented hot extremes bears a signature or has a human contribution. And so we're able to put quantitative numbers on some of these incredibly complicated phenomena.
And so what are some of those other things that we maybe can attribute, or what do we not attribute that we should be attributing? I think maybe there are things that are definitely climate is contributing to it, but we are not thinking about it. I think sometimes we tend to just look at the extreme things. We're you know, before the break, we were talking about how so many people were focusing on the water temperature around Hurricane Irma and speculating and about how that might be connected to climate change. But what are those kind of everyday things that we're maybe not looking at that are really most likely connected to climate?
So I think one of the things that we don't look at in this study, but I think is incredibly interesting, and we talked a bit in the break about this, and this is the concept of time and how it's difficult for people to kind of wrap their heads around time and changes in time. And, you know, extreme events in the climate world are kind of the tip of the spear. This is what makes people sit up and notice the weather around them. This is something that affects their life, and it could affect their life in a very bad way. But climate change isn't just extreme events. Climate change is also slowly increasing temperatures through time. And one of the ramifications of that is that the zones in which certain plants will grow have slowly started to shift north. And I think that's rather fascinating. Having grown up, planted a garden and looked at the back of your seed pack, it tells you different places where this particular crop can grow. And we've started to see these progress northward. And not only so, there's a positive to that. Maybe we get to grow some things that we weren't able to grow before. But there's negatives with that, because that means that certain pests that at one time couldn't live in a particular area can now live in that area. So these are things that are happening rather slowly that perhaps we're not as citizens seeing or directly linking with climate change.
Right, right. I've seen a little bit of that conversation too. I'm a big garden person, and I've seen a lot of garden blogs start to talk about that. It's like, well, even if you're in this zone, you can probably grow this, you can probably do this. And I think there's some conversation there too about how that might impact, say, growing zones or for beekeepers, and how that might change timeframes for pollinators in places that normally have a really short growing season, which I think is interesting, because we tend to talk about this kind of stuff only in negatives. But of course, for every, you know, every win, there's a trade-off somewhere, I'm sure. And so what are people normally getting wrong when you see people informally outside of your field talking about climate or voicing their concerns to you? What does the narrative miss, or what do people normally get wrong?
Well, I think a lot of times people are very focused on the weather. And so you have an unseasonably cool summer, or you have a big snowstorm or something along those lines, people often look at that and point to that and say, climate change is not actually occurring. Mm-hmm. And I think they're missing the bigger picture, the slower changes that are not necessarily, not every event is going to be an extreme event and hit you over the head and tell you that it's climate change.
Yeah. And so kind of stepping back a little bit and looking at global climate and things we know that human beings have contributed to. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, corporate responsibility and regulation, and we talk a lot about that. Are we, you know, we see polar ice caps melting. We see all this stuff that seems so scary and so horrifying. And I think it's easy to take our minds to a place of, is it too late? Are we doing anything? You know, the things that we're trying to do to mitigate it, is it working? Is it helpful? You know, where maybe even in your own life, how have you kind of shifted how you maybe run your house or approach recycling or anything like that?
Yeah. So, you know, in the world of climate science, we often talk about mitigation and we talk about adaptation. So mitigation is reducing our use of fossil fuels. And adaptation is preparing for those changes. Mm. And preparing for those changes essentially means increasing the resilience of community members. And one of the things that I think is important to talk about in relation to climate change is this idea of justice. And, you know, a nation like the U.S. that has lots of resources, if you look at the damages that, say, a Harvey or an Irma cause here, and then you take that same storm and you put it somewhere else, say you put it in India or Bangladesh, and you look at the impacts, well, there's going to be substantial financial impacts to the U.S. from these storms. But in terms of the loss of life, it's going to be quite a bit less. And that's because we have the infrastructure and we have built resilience into our system. Whereas in developing nations, there's a much larger risk there for them from climate change. And the irony of the situation is that many of the folks in those developing nations didn't contribute to the problem, and yet they're going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. I think that's so essential to think about when we talk about climate and responsibility and justice, to not just think about it, what's happening in our own borders, that it really is a big balance. There's a lot to it, and it's all global. And those are really excellent points that you bring up. We have been talking with Dr. Daniel Horton from Northwestern University, assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences. I feel like we need 2 more hours to talk about all the things, but thank you for joining us tonight and sharing your knowledge with us. We are going to take a break and check in with news here in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. I appreciate you being with us tonight and sharing part of your Saturday with us. As ever, we take one big topic and we spend the entire program taking a look at different aspects of it. And given headlines we are looking at right now coming out of the Gulf area, certainly tonight's topic, of course, had to be focusing on weather and climate and hazards, because that is so much on so many people's minds right now. So we're joined right now by phone by meteorologist Jesse Ventruella, who is based in the Gulf. Jesse, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Hey, how you doing, Amy? Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us and taking time out of what I'm sure is a very busy time for you there in the Gulf. So talk us through. We've been keeping tabs on everything happening with Irma and, of course, Jose coming in behind her, but more urgently, yeah. Irma. So what are you seeing there in the Gulf area?
Well, I mean, you know, for Irma right now, obviously this is, you know, this has quickly become a very serious situation for you know, the Florida Peninsula, and it's kind of, you know, for the last really week or so, you know, we like to track the models. They kind of flipped back and forth a little bit, but I like to say, you know, when you get to about a 3 or 4 day before the storm makes landfall, the models usually lock into a certain location. And unfortunately for the west coast of Florida now, and the Florida Keys too, it looks like the models have locked in, and they're going to feel some really, you know, serious impacts from the system starting tonight and then, you know, going into tomorrow and tomorrow evening as well. This is really setting up to be, you know, I was talking about it earlier. This is almost, you know, to me, almost a worst case scenario track for the state of Florida, because all the major cities, you know, first starting with the Keys, I mean, they're going to take just a really bad hit from this system, as it looks to just go right through the Florida Keys. So I know everybody, you know, that's a mandatory evacuation for the Florida Keys. So I'm really hoping that people heeded the warnings and they got out of there. But then going even farther to the north now, we're talking Naples, Fort Myers, Sarasota, Tampa. After that, if this thing hugs the western coastline, as it looks like it's going to, this is going to create some major storm surge problems on the west side of that, of the state of Florida. I mean, you know, some of the estimates have Naples at, 10 to 15 feet of storm surge inside the city there. And then moving to the north, you have Fort Myers and Sarasota with the potential for about 5 to 10 feet of storm surge, and then up to Tampa right now at 5 to 8 feet of storm surge. So right now, this is just shaping up to be a really bad looking scenario for especially the West Coast. But the eastern side of these hurricanes are usually the worst part of the storm. So that's going to put not only the West Coast right in around the eye wall, but now you got the whole state that's going to be on the worst side of the storm. So areas even as far east as Miami already are seeing some surge coming in. They're expecting to get about 3 to 6 feet, but then Orlando and even Jacksonville going up that way. So it's really setting up to just be a bad situation for Florida with Irma right now, unfortunately.
Right. And I have seen a lot of conversation around Tampa in particular, just because of the geography there, that bay area. And so the potential for landfall there being significantly worse than if it was in another area of Florida.
Well, yeah, because there's nowhere for the water to go there. If you look at the topography and how Tampa is situated, you have the bay coming in from the Gulf, so that the Gulf connects into the bay there. So as that water goes into the bay and that water keeps getting pushed in, there's nowhere for it to escape except to go into the city and to bring some water into the city. Some areas, depending on elevation, can get a little bit more than others. But the topography of Tampa is really one of the most vulnerable areas on that West Coast. But it's really, not only Tampa, but everyone in that west coast of Florida is just looking to take a major hit from this system. And I think the main thing is I just hope people are taking it serious over there in Florida. And it really, if they said mandatory evacuations were issued, I just hope they left. Because sometimes people say, well, I got through this storm okay, but this is a different storm. This is much worse than what we've seen in recent memory, especially a storm that's affecting Florida. So, you can't really judge past storms for the current storm that's out there. Just because you survived or you got through one storm, relatively okay, this is a totally different situation and one that I've personally not seen a track like this with this strong of a storm, and I've just never seen one like this. So, it just remains to be seen as, how much of an impact they're going to, they're actually going to see from this. But the models are indicating it's not going to be pretty. So, yeah, it's just going to be something to really just wait and see and track this thing live as it goes in the west coast of Florida. But right now, it just does not look good.
Right. I keep hearing meteorologists talking that way of just, this is not something I've seen. I this is unique. And that really, to me, just underscores the importance of listening to those evacuation orders and listening to local officials. Earlier, I heard comment from the mayor of Key West who said he was going to ride it out and he felt very confident in a government building. And I just, that seems so scary to me, but I know there are a lot of first responders and public officials that are feeling like they kind of need to stay there and keep a hand on the wheel, and that's so scary in this environment.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I'm not for certain what type of structure he'll be staying in. I know the National Weather Service in Key West as well. They've said that we'll be here for you. We're going to be riding out this storm, but I believe they're in a very secure concrete location, and I think it's elevated pretty good. So, it just really depends on the structure, that you're staying in. But, many of the residents are not in these types of structures. They're right on the water. I mean, that's the beauty of living in the Keys. You're right. You're in the beautiful views. You get it most of the year. But unfortunately, on this time of the year, this can happen. So a lot of the residents there are not going to be in these types of structures. And, I already saw a video just from about an hour ago, and the water is already starting to rise. And that storm is still not really going to make, that official landfall, that official pass of the Keys until about daybreak tomorrow. So it's only going to continue to get worse there. And I just, especially in the Keys, so it's just so vulnerable there from the storm surge to come in. That's what I really hope. They just took it serious, just because they've survived storms in the past. Like I was saying before, this one's just going to be something that we haven't seen in some time.
Right, right. And so as we were watching Irma travel across the Caribbean, and we've seen a death toll at this point up to 23, but perhaps that could rise in the coming days because there are still areas without communication just due to infrastructure restraints. How many bureaus are we really looking at that need to come together when we're tracking a storm like this through different areas, through different territories, different countries? And I ask that because in particular, a lot of people on social media were noting that their weather apps could only show portions of Irma once it entered into U.S. area. So it wasn't showing anything over Cuba, and it wasn't showing anything further out in the Caribbean. So in when we're looking at storms entering the Gulf, what is that process of coordinating with different different bureaus and authoritative bodies?
Well, I mean, as far as the different radar sites, there's limited radar sites out there. With the storms in the Caribbean. I mean, when we got to, once it started to approach, you know, Puerto Rico north of San Juan, there's a radar station there, so we could really see where that eyewall was. I mean, I think some government agencies and maybe insiders have some access to radars that the general public don't have access to kind of track these systems. But I can tell you as, you know, meteorologists and looking for the different radar sites, you know, they have Puerto Rico, but then once it leaves the Puerto Rico radar, it goes over toward, you know, the islands, Turks and Caicos, and then over toward Cuba. And there's not much radar there to be able to track either. So now we're starting to see the radar site in Key West picking up the storm. So we got a very good handle on it now because now we have a high-res radar. We can see the eye on the radar. It's easier to track the motion of the system now on this radar. But there's just not there's not much readily available information out there when it's well out in the Caribbean to be able to track it. But we do have the reconnaissance planes that are very important in this situation that are flying into the system that can, you know, actually they drop the drop signs into the system. They take the pressure readings. They get the, you know, they get the reading of where the center of circulation is, and they'll go by every 3 hours to see where it changed from one point to another to see where it's moving, how much it's strengthened, and you know how strong the winds are at that point. So the reconnaissance planes flying into it are vital when it's out there way out in the Caribbean near the Lesser Antilles and then pushing it toward the Virgin Islands, because they're keeping track of the – because they have a little radar on their actual plane that they can kind of track the storm with. So that's really the most important information that's relayed back over to the National Hurricane Center when the storms are well out there. Once it gets closer, we can track these, you know, we can track the hurricanes on our radar sites. And it finally got onto the Key West radar, you know, earlier this morning and afternoon. So we got a pretty good handle on it now that we can track the motion of it.
And those flights are so fascinating, and several of them have been traveling with cameras and GoPros and all of those kind of things.
Yes.
And sharing that really, really unbelievable footage of flying right over the eye of it and really just seeing firsthand exactly what that looks like. It looks like a terrifying flight, but, you know, so kudos
it's
to
crazy.
Everyone that's doing that for sure.
And it's crazy.
Yeah, it seems like
I don't know how they do it. I think I'd be very frightened.
Yeah, nerves of steel on anyone on those flights, for sure. They look very turbulence does not even begin to describe
that's what
it.
I was about to say. It's the ultimate turbulence in that, because they get flight level. They get flight level winds, you know, that are, you know, I mean, the surface level winds are, you know, were at like 185 when it was out there and they were flying into it. So flight level winds are probably about 10 to 15 miles per hour above that. I just can't imagine, you know, flying around in that type of wind, that type of pressure. I mean, I just don't know. And these things hold up too. I mean, these planes hold up in those conditions, and it's just, it's crazy. Like, I don't think I could ever do that. I'd be so nervous flying into those flights, but I'm so thankful that we have folks that are brave enough to get us the readings from out there.
Right. They do it so we don't have to. That's right.
Exactly.
And so, you know, this hurricane season seems a little bit unique because it kicked off a little bit earlier than normal, and there's been a lot of conversation around that water temperature being so much warmer than it usually is, and really that playing such a key role in feeding and powering Irma. And so what do you hear? I'm sure that there's so much you hear that's either kind of conjecture or misconception or just kind of false narratives about hurricane season. But in your mind, what is standing out is really unique and really, really important to note about this hurricane season?
Well, I mean, look, here's the thing. To me, these hurricane season, they seem to go in cycles, where you'll have a very, you know, a couple of active seasons, and then you'll have a little bit of a downtime, and you'll have another active season. A few years, it's not so active, and then this year, it's very active again. But really, it's there's so many ingredients that go into a tropical system becoming an Irma or a Harvey or a Katrina. You know the big ones that we've had in history. It's not just the water temperature. That's just one ingredient for these things. You can have 100-degree water out there, but if you don't have the upper level winds that are conducive for development, and you don't have dry air can get in the system and really start to infect the circulation and not let it develop. There are so many ingredients that come together that have to be almost perfect for one of these storms to develop like this. And if just one of them is off, it's going to disrupt the circulation, and we're not going to get a strong hurricane like this. And I think that's why we don't get them so often. We don't have these types of storms every season. They're rare. Thank goodness they're rare. But it's a lot more than just warm water temperatures out there. I mean, the Gulf is going to be warm every season. The Caribbean is going to be warm every summer. You know, out there in the Atlantic, it's always going to be warm. Yes, it can fluctuate a temperature or two every season, but it's always all you need for a hurricane to develop is 80 degrees, 80 degrees Fahrenheit. Anything 80 or above, you can get a tropical system to form. Right. Not just that. And thank God it's not just that, because if it was just water temperatures that you can get one of these things to form from, you'd have one forming every week. But you got to have the right ingredients. And then not only that, you can have a strong storm develop and become a Cat 5, but then it can hook out to sea and harmlessly just go out to sea and not affect anyone. So not only do you have to have all the ingredients in place, but then the steering currents have to be bad, or, you know, a bad steering current that's going to steer it toward the United States enough that it's going to actually make landfall. So there's so many different, you know, ingredients that go in place. And unfortunately, the last 2 weeks, we've had Harvey that, you know, formed fast. And then we just happen to have a blocking high pressure to the north of Harvey. So when it made landfall, it just gets blocked. It stops and just dumps, you know, just unearthly amounts of rainfall over toward Houston. Just a very bad timing situation there. And then Irma here forms out there. And all of a sudden, this high pressure to the north of Irma is very strong right now. So it just continues to ride along that. And unfortunately, it did not make a turn to the north in time, and now it's going to make that turn, but it's a little too late for the west coast of Florida. So I think that's just the most important thing, you know, that there's just so much that goes into these systems for one to develop like this. And just thank goodness it takes so much, because they don't happen often, but when they do, they can be very bad.
Right. And then we have these other two that we haven't really addressed yet, just because Irma is so urgent. Here we're watching it just minute by minute. But it seems as if, anyway, that Jose will be a relatively kind of non-event. It seems like he's going to stay out in the ocean and not bother too many people. But then we look south in the Gulf to Katia, looking like it's going to make landfall in Mexico. And what about that area? What do we need to know about that storm?
Well, Katia is actually now dissipated. The National Hurricane Center has actually made the last advisory on Katia. It made landfall, moved into Mexico. It's going to now, they're going to have some really bad rainfall in that area. But as far as advisories, the National Hurricane Center is not watching anymore. So that one's done. Now, Jose, honestly, Jose right now, it's got to be monitored. It has to be monitored. It doesn't look like right now it's going to be affecting the U.S., but neither did Irma about 10 days ago. So forecasts that are longer than seven, you know, you get out in time 5 to 8 days and longer than that. It's just forecasting that far out is just not relative. There's not a lot of confidence in it at this point. So we got to wait a little while. Irma's going to pass. I'm sure we're going to deal with big problems with Irma. And then at that point, we'll start paying attention to Jose. But right, it's a strong storm out there. So yeah. It's something we kind of watch. But at this point, let's watch Irma first. But, you know, there's some models that are kind of keeping Jose out there, lingering around this high and kind of stalling a little bit. And then who knows where he goes after that. At this point, it's a little bit too far out. But it's certainly something to look at. Look, this is the peak. Actually, September 10th is the official peak of hurricane season, where in history, that's typically the most active time. So you got the peak there, and then you start kind of trending downward from this time in the season. So it's not surprising that this is all happening, but it is, you know, I have not seen two storms of this magnitude make landfall like this within a matter of 2 weeks of each other. The other season that was close was 2005, and that was the one with Katrina and Rita and Wilma, and it was just an unbelievable season where they had 28 named storms and had to go into the Greek alphabet by the end of it because they ran out of names. And the biggest thing about the 2005 season is that it had so much impact as well, and then it looks like this season as well. It's very active, but the most important thing with it is that there's a lot of impact. And I think that's the most important thing with these hurricane seasons. You can have 60 storms, but if none of them made landfall in the U.S., it was a very active season with no impact, which I will take. This one does not look good because it seems like now we're going to have two major impacts in a matter of 14 days.
Right, right. And I think that the model, the predictive model, as you pointed out, looking too far ahead, probably not the best use of our time, because even last night, it looked as if Irma was going to make landfall straight down the middle of Florida and just go straight up to Georgia. And that shift kind of happened. The National Hurricane Center issued that slight update, and we see both the European and U.S. models both kind of pulling it to the west, and suddenly things got very different and much realer. And I think everybody kind of shifted their focus a little bit, which was very interesting. So what we do now, I think this is the hard part. We wait, we see what happens, not a ton to do except just kind of be there and respond afterwards. But it seems that the most immediate impact will be about storm surge and wind debris.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, the models are locked. The track is pretty much locked. Can it fluctuate 5, 10, maybe 15, 20 miles east or west? Yeah, I mean, it still can. But I think the thing is, this storm is massive. So even if you don't get into the eye wall, this hurricane winds are extending out 80 miles from the center. So 80 miles to the east, 80 miles to the west. The Florida Peninsula is 120 miles across. So if this thing hugs the coast, it's going to go 80 miles inland with hurricane force winds. So even if you don't feel the center of circulation, obviously the center is where the surge is going to be worst, but everyone in Florida, I don't recall in the past where we've had a hurricane warning for the entire peninsula of Florida, but that's what we have right now, just because it's such a massive system. So there's just so much of an impact that's going to be felt along, most of Florida here. I mean, if you look at the map, I mean, like you go like maybe Pensacola to the west, that western part of the panhandle, they're not going to feel too much, but everyone else east of it is going to feel something from this, something from this system. I just think that's the biggest thing. I think the last stat I saw is that 6 million, I think, have evacuated from Florida. I think that may have gone up, but the last one I saw, 6 million have actually evacuated.
I hope
it's just a large scam.
Yeah, I hope that number has gone up. It seems like I think I saw 17 million people were in what was considered a dangerous area. So I hope that number has gone way
up. I hope it has too, because that would be like way less than 50% of the people who have gotten out of the, so to speak, danger areas.
Indeed. All right. Well, we have been talking with Gulf-based meteorologist Jesse Ventruella. Thank you so much for being with us. We will keep turning to you. You have this wonderful Facebook resource for everybody. You can, everybody, find it. It is facebook.com/Gulf Coast Hurricane Updates. You can find all kind of wonderful data, and you'll be keeping us updated through Irma and beyond. So thank you so much for joining us tonight. I appreciate you being with us.
I appreciate it, Amy. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to get you to news, check in on the latest with Hurricane Irma. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us tonight. This is the Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we pick one big topic and we start talking about it all night. And as the show begins to wind up, we have more questions than we started with, of course. And tonight we're talking about weather, environment, climate, and our hazard vulnerability. There's a lot going on in our news right now. We've been monitoring Hurricane Irma that's just now getting into making landfall in Florida over the next several hours. So we're keeping you updated on that. And we've been talking about that in particular. But I want to shift now to another story that's happening right here in the United States and that is on a lot of people's minds. And it is also very, very serious. series, and that is the conversation about the many wildfires that are happening in the west area of the U.S., because that is also a very big issue and a very big story and on a lot of people's minds, and indeed changing lives and changing, you know, putting a lot of people in very vulnerable positions. So joining us to talk about that is Joan Anselmo, who is the former spokesperson of the National Park Service. Joan, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yes, I am.
There we go. Sorry about that. Technical difficulties snag us every time. Sorry about that. Thanks so much. Well, I appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday evening to talk with us. We've been talking a lot about hazard vulnerability tonight, a great deal in the context of Hurricane Irma as we're watching that. But as we shift west, we see so much happening west of the Mississippi River in terms of wildfires. And they, you know, I think it's competing for there's a tension between the West Coast and the East Coast right now in our headlines, just because I think there's only so much bandwidth in a given news organization and for the average reader. But indeed, there are some very serious situations unfolding on the West Coast. So in your view, because you have watched this, you have seen these happen for the time that you have been with the National Park Service, even some very high profile ones. Talk us through what we're seeing right now on the West Coast.
First of all, I think tonight we all have to be thinking about what the firefighters are going through throughout the western United States. It's not just on the West Coast. It's about 9 states in the West, and especially in Montana and Oregon right now. There are about 2 million acres on fire, something like 28,000 firefighters, including the pilots and the support personnel to support the aircraft that are fighting these blazes. And we're beginning to see just unprecedented fire behavior. So things have changed in the last few years, and this summer is testing all the emergency services of our country. And so, you know, I'm praying that there will be no loss of life on the fires. There have been loss of homes and other structures. There have been rolling evacuations. Thousands of people have been evacuated, whether California, Oregon, Washington, Montana, Idaho, and other places. And, you know, the fire season, unfortunately, is not over. And so we're going to be hoping that the weather that is moving in over the next couple days does not make things worse. That's a question mark right now for all of the folks who are in the line of fire. And these are just really dangerous times.
Right. And so why have we seen this change? And what is it? What is the factor that really made the most difference and shifted the most to see us contribute to this really active fire season?
Well, of course, for the last 10 years, We've seen a lot of big fire in the western United States and even in Alaska, of course. But this year, what I'm reading that is coming from different scientists and fire behavior specialists is that there's been a high pressure system that has held over the western United States from the west coast inward into areas of Montana and Wyoming and North Dakota and Idaho. And there's been very little change in that high pressure system. And so the air has remained stagnant. That whole part of the country is smoked in. So even though I'm talking to you in Wyoming and we do not have much active fire, our area, our state has been smoked in for the last 6 weeks due to the fire activity all over the West. So people are experiencing different parts of this fire, but some of the most dramatic firefighting and visuals that are terrifying if you live in those areas, and certainly if you're fighting the fires, have come this summer from Montana and Oregon. And there's so much at risk, certainly human life first and foremost, but properties and businesses. And in the case of Oregon, the Bull Run watershed, which is the water source for Portland and other parts of Oregon, is at risk right now, and wildlife and the salmon fishery. So, you know, it goes on, and commerce has pretty much been very impacted. Interstate 84 in Oregon has had to be temporarily closed in some sections. And then in Montana, Highway 200, there's been a series of fires in Montana. So the people who live there and then the people who are trying to conduct business are having a heck of a time moving around. So sadly, this could be the new normal as we see temperatures rise, high pressure systems hold without any storms to change the weather pattern, and man really can't stop wildfires on the scale that we see now. So we have to make decisions about how much are we going to risk the lives of firefighters to save structures and to save other valuable parts of our lives. So it's really a debate that has to happen once the fires are cooled and everyone is safe and sound back in their homes and the firefighters are back home.
Right. And I want to talk about that impact here a little bit. But I also, you know, I think that there's a narrative out there when we think about fires. I think there's kind of a widespread belief anyway that there's some degree, oh, it's the cycle of life. Things need to burn and it's good for the forest. And I think sometimes there is almost a hesitation for people to grasp the full severity of fire, because it seems like somewhere in the narrative it became quite normal or expected or almost important to have these fires.
Well, it's very situational, though, by the specific area that is having fire or is on fire. It's by the jurisdiction. You know, if it's a national park, some of the places that I worked where you don't have the same private property concerns that you have in cities and towns that are facing these fires, you have a little more flexibility about how you manage fires. And certainly these forests have evolved with fires over the millennia. So fire has always played a role in our land, in our landscapes, our geography, and even in creating habitat. But then you have an awful lot of changes. You know, the scientists, again, will document the hotter temperatures that we're having, the hot temperatures over land, the much increased temperatures in the sea. And so things have changed, and then you have so many more millions of people wanting to live in these beautiful areas that are adjacent to public lands, next to a national forest or a national park, to be able to enjoy all the recreation opportunities those public lands offer us. But that's at a cost as well, because you begin to push further into wild places, and fire is a part of it. So then you have to decide how much you manage it, how you fight it. But certainly right now, with the national preparedness level for wildland fire, it's at the highest level. It's at level 5. All of the federal resources are on different fires in the country. There's really no more resources. And the military has moved in to help with certain special equipment and some of the aircraft. So you've completely tapped out the federal system to help fight the fires. And obviously those systems will work closely with states and local jurisdictions in an interagency manner. But I don't think people are thinking any of these fires are good. So it's very, very specific to the location where the fire ignites, how it ignites, and then looking at the land base, the drought conditions, the fuel loading, meaning how dry are the trees and the grasses. So it's pretty complex science.
Indeed. And there's always so much to it. You know, I think we get kind of a single view of what it means to, say, fight a fire or manage fires. And we get very attached to that and not realize what all goes into that. But you said earlier, we really can't stop fire. So I wonder if you could break down for us a bit. What are the strategies? I'm sure they have evolved in any field, in any practice. Of course, technology changes things daily. But right now, what is the most common strategy that is put into consideration when we're talking about dealing with fires? And as we're looking at numbers, as you said, 28,000 firefighters working on fires right now in the Western United States. What are the strategies put in place mainly for widespread fires like this?
First and foremost, and this is universal throughout all of the federal agencies that are fighting fires along with their partners in the state and local jurisdictions, is firefighter safety. So that decisions are made first and foremost to not put firefighters at undue risk. The work is inherently risky, of course, but that is literally the number one priority, is to make sure that you're not putting people in front of walls of flame or putting them in situations where they will become entrapped. And sadly, we have a history of that happening. And you know, statistically, sometimes the best of laid plans don't work. But the fire managers that are on each incident are looking at the specifics of that incident. So is it a forested area with old growth forest? Is it an area that has been logged? What are the values at risk? You know, is it right next to a town? Because sometimes you're literally looking to save a town. So if it's a suppression action, they're going to use different structural protection for homes that may be at risk or for other structures that may be at risk. They may foam those homes. They may use fire retardant. I mean, it's difficult to talk about a single strategy because it's so specific to an individual fire. Sometimes, depending again on the topography, firefighters working line will dig fire line literally to make a break in the fuel so that the fire cannot continually run. So you try and create a fuel break. And you have to look at the boundaries or the perimeter of the fire, which way is the wind blowing, what are the weather forecasts. And fire weather predicting is a very special science, and there are fire weather specialists on most of these big incidents that do only tracking of weather so that you don't put people in the middle of fighting a fire if the wind is going to change. So, again, it's a very complex science. It's very situational if you're working in grasslands versus mountains, if you're working in a heavily forested area or kind of a forest that has had some natural fire where there's more of a break in that fuel source. It's not continuous. So the strategy, of course, is to contain a fire, to prevent its spread after, again, human life being the high priority, and then you manage it, you steer it. But what I have been reading on the fires in Oregon and in Montana, they have been so severe, so hot, with no change in the weather, that they're even doing some selective fire control and firefighting at night, which is typically not done because it's so dangerous for the firefighters to do that. So that hopefully gives you a little sense of some of the tactics.
Right, right. I mean, it is a very interesting one. And I know there's that photo that I think is just kind of ricocheting around the internet right now of from Oregon near a golf course where it shows, you know, people playing golf yes. quite calmly with these right. fires raging in the background. And so those are important considerations, of course. We're talking with Joan Anselmo, who was the former spokesperson of 35 years for the National Park Service. So when we're talking fires, here's someone who really knows all about them. And so I want to shift now, Joan, to talking a bit about impact, because so often we look at the fire, we hear about acreage, and then we hear it's contained, and we don't hear a ton more about it in that main narrative and in major news outlets. But I want to talk about that impact, because I know that some fires have really far-reaching impacts that perhaps aren't obvious. Perhaps they're not just about loss of structures and lives, but perhaps about water supply and endangered species and habitat and bigger things. What do we look to after a fire has ended?
Well, those are really great questions because, again, depending on the topography, is it a mountain forested area? Is it a river valley? You know, again, specific to the location. But I know that right now, looking at the fires in Oregon, particularly the ones in the Columbia River Gorge, that's been very steep terrain, and part of I-84 had to close because so many trees and so many boulders have fallen on the interstate. So, you know, the first thing that has to happen is a removal of hazard trees. So various teams from the different agencies will assess where can they get in safely to take down hazard trees so they don't fall on cars or people. Obviously, a lot of these wildlands are places that people recreate. They hike, they camp, and soon the hunting season opens on some of these public lands. So all of that has to be taken into account. You look at the watersheds. Are there watersheds that are going to be impacted? What can be done to protect them? Sometimes steep hillsides that may have been fully burned, they tend to erode. And if they're near, you know, depending, again, what the topography is, landslides are a big risk after certain kinds of fires in really steep terrain. So the managers, the specialists, will be out there assessing fire by fire what has to be done. And I would say initially this year, it seems like in many of the national forests that have burned, one of the priorities will be to remove the hazard fuel and to salvage some of the wood that can be salvaged through timber operations. And then assessments of wildlife, you know, wildlife evolved with these fires. So in many instances, they move out of the way, though some do not make it. I mean, that's, again, very variable by the type of fire. But the work is really just beginning as the fires cool. And some of these fires will not be put out until Mother Nature puts them out with snow or soaking rain.
Which could be quite a while, really. And so I want to back up a bit to water supply in particular. What are those considerations? Is it about access and having enough water? Is it about pollutants after? What are the considerations when we're looking around concerns to a water supply after a fire event?
Well, again, depending on what the water supply is being used for, in the case of drinking water, in most instances when aerial support is dropping fire retardant on fires to try and save structures and to dampen really intense fires. Most of the time, fire retardant is not put directly into sources that are drinking water sources. So that's been something that the Forest Service has tried to steer away from. But there is an exception to do that. If the fire is severe enough, they may need to drop fire retardant that would get into that water supply. And basically, after that happens, then the water supply has to be tested and monitored and sometimes treated. And in the case of the Bull Run water supply, which is Portland's water supply, it's one of the purest water supplies anywhere in the United States for a municipality. And right now, they don't have to filter it. They don't even have to treat it. But depending on what yet plays out in the Columbia River Gorge, that could change for them. I hope not. Most of the natural water sources will recover if they don't have to have much retardant put in them, if that makes sense to you.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Because, again, these are mountains and streams that have evolved with fire for a long time. I think that it's going to be the shock for the people who live in those places because, again, thousands of people have evacuated in different parts of these states where the fires have been the most intense. They have to come back, and many of them have lost their homes, but even if they haven't lost the home, the landscape around them is going to be very different looking than when they left. There will be an effort in some areas of the National Forest to do some reseeding when those assessments are completed to try and restore some of the forest, you know, with the help of man versus naturally. And, you know, we all love our beautiful wilderness experiences, a forest experience, a park experience, and we always think of them as these beautiful, pristine, green places. But increasingly, these places are subject to large-scale wildfire, and they change. It changes the look of the places, and you have to kind of prepare yourself for that. It can impact tourism, which is another big issue for many of these communities. They are very much destinations for tourists, visitors, who want to go there to enjoy those outdoor areas, those recreational opportunities. And so, you know, there's going to be a huge economic impact to a lot of those communities. And those are discussions that the country has to have nationally, just as they're having about the aftermath of hurricanes, because there's huge after impacts. And today I heard the Forest Service chief speak to the cost to date. And thus far this year, between all the federal agencies, they have spent $2 billion in fighting fires. And it's not over yet. And that's the suppression cost. That's not the restoration and recovery costs that lie ahead. So it's really important to keep that in mind as we debate all these budgets. It would be a tragedy if the budgets for these firefighting agencies, the land management agencies, were cut at a time when we see fires like this increased every single year.
Right. If anything, they should be increased to address them. Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I wish I could talk with you for hours more. Mm-hmm. This is so very interesting. As ever, we dive into a topic and there's so much more to it, but we will keep an eye on the fires and hope the best for all 28,000 plus firefighters out there. I hope that everybody is nice and safe, and I hope all the fires get under control quickly. Get on it, Mother Nature. So,
yes, please.
Indeed.
I hope so. Mother Nature's trying to show she's in charge this year for sure, you know?
Right, for sure. She's maybe paying a little too much attention to the East Coast right now. If she could share that and send it west, that would be good. Well, Joan Anselmo, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate you joining us and sharing your expertise with us.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
Thanks so much. All right, we're going to take a break, get you to news, and hear the latest about Hurricane Irma here in just a bit on 720 WGN.